Hey everyone, get off behind the scenes thing here. We recorded this episode that you're about to listen to on Wednesday, and it is now Saturday, and we are just a little over around 12 hours since the announcement of the passing of actor Chadwick Boseman. So we are getting together to do this a quick little this little talk about it. Of course, Chadwick, for the Disney fans, was the Black Panther in the Marvel movies.
King
And
T'Challa.
King T'Challa, he king on screen and off, from what everyone has been saying about this guy.
Absolutely. I have yet to have heard a negative word about the man. Everything, not even just with death, as we tend to gloss over some of those things in the early stages of grief, but even before his death, no one seemed to have a bad word to say about him, which is an impressive legacy to leave behind.
Yeah, and he himself thanked many people to go in his. I think his career was to many people a big thing. Going to shoot, I remember there was someone he who paid his schooling.
Denzel Washington, I believe.
Yes, Denzel Washington. He did a big thing to Denzel Washington, who paid for his schooling. And he tried to pay that forward as best as he could, while being an activist, and trying to be a positive role model. And I think he did a damn good job at it.
Granted, as we've said before, neither of us are black, and although we feel this loss pretty keenly, just being fans and Marvel fans and all that, the outpouring of grief that I've seen from not only the black people in my life, but just kind of on the internet in general, on TV, on the news. My heart goes out to everybody who really needed this as a personal form of representation.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big thing. I mean, there's been artwork of kids looking up to the Black Panther as, that's them on screen. And to have that character, the kind of character, to show that, at least to this generation, that, a black person can play a superhero, and a very successful superhero, as Black Panther was one of the biggest Marvel movies to date. And it's.
Yeah, I mean, Black Panther certainly broke so many records, but I know that given what Black Panther meant to people and meant to the black community, I know that that community in specific was looking forward to more of those. Who wouldn't?
Yeah, I mean, they've been talk about it. Obviously, the next phase after the current films, yeah, and we'll have to see when we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. We'll find out then.
But of course, back to the more important thing. It wasn't, we talk about Disney, so we focus on the Disney and the Marvel stuff here, but I mean, he had played Thurgood Marshall previously in
Jackie
his
Robinson,
career, Jackie
James
Robinson, I
Brown,
mean, James Brown. He
Get
was
On Up is a great movie if you have not seen that movie.
Yeah, and I encourage you to go watch all these movies. I mean, that they were all good. The interesting thing is that this was a man who was not only known for standing up for his community in real life because he was very into advocacy, to giving back, like you said before. Especially, I believe, on the educational front, making sure that the generations of black children after him got the proper access to education that they should. But he was also into advocacy on film. It seemed with the roles that he took that that was always the foremost thing in his mind. He did not appear to be an actor who was just taking any role just to act. I mean, there was some of that, of course, because there always is. I mean, let's just face it. Everybody's got to eat. But it seemed that when he got a little bit of fame and a little bit more choice, he became incredibly selective in how he thought that a black man and the black community in general should be represented on screen. And I can respect that. If, you know, I of course can't and never would try to speak to the black experience, but I do know how much seeing a broader female representation on screen has meant to me, especially in the past few years, and wishing I had grown up with that. And I know that we've talked before with you and Latino representation, seeing that on screen and how that's impacted you. Mm-hmm. And I'm just thinking that there are generations now, not just this current one, but ones that haven't even been born yet, that thanks to Chadwick Boseman's work will not grow up missing that. Mm-hmm. They will always have a representation of Wakanda. They will always have these amazing portraits of Jackie Robinson, Thurgood Marshall, and so on. So I think that that's his true legacy going forward, and I can't imagine a better legacy to leave behind.
Gone too soon. 43 is way too young to be going.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's just a couple of years older than we are. So, yeah. I mean, he was a contemporary, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
So, if you got a few extra bucks, maybe donate it to cancer research or a worthy charity serving the black community. Might be a good thing to do it in memory of him now. This one took all of us by surprise.
That just came out, punched you right in the gut.
Yeah, I mean, it hit me like a ton of bricks when I saw that. And of course, like everybody else, immediately I was like, this can't be factual. Because I think the first thing I saw was somebody shared it on TMZ. And, you know, sometimes they're not the most reliable. And I thought, that this can't possibly be right. And it says he has cancer. We would have known if he had had cancer. And, you know. But it was unfortunately all too real. And such a loss.
Cancer sucks. I think that's all anyone can really say about it.
Yeah.
So,
we will miss you, Chadwick. Thank you for everything you've done for us, and of course everything you did for the black community. We're not the right people to thank you for that, but
you'll always be a king here.
Yeah.
I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. We've been Disney fans our entire lives, and now as childless adults, we're undertaking a journey through the media that shaped our lives,
trying to find out if what made them special is still there.
We are Rewatching the Magic.
Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Tuesday.
Oh, what an episode we've got today.
We're heading back to Lucasfilm.
Yeah, Lucasfilm. And we haven't talked Disney about Lucasfilm. Yeah, we haven't talked about Lucasfilm since our Star Wars episode, I believe.
Yeah.
And there's this weird thing about Lucasfilm movies, at least these early ones, in that you can tell that there's a lot of influence from George Lucas's own life. Like, Star Wars was based off his love of
cereals and Japanese films, Kurosawa films, yeah.
Oh, I mean, I was going to say, like, Flash Gordon.
yeah, those old sci-fi serials, yeah.
And even Indiana Jones was also based off that love of old serials, action-adventure, stuff like that. You ever get the feeling that George Lucas may have at least read at least one of the Lord of the Rings books at one point?
I think everybody of that generation did, so I'm not really sure that's, like, a big shocker.
I mean, because that's what we're kind of doing. Lord of the Rings, the books have been around for years, like decades.
20 years at this point, maybe? Yeah.
Yeah, by the time we get to the 80s, it's been around about 20 years. So, and we haven't yet gotten to the point of the Lord of the Rings movies. Game of Thrones was just a glimmer in George R. R. Martin's eye. That's what I was trying to say.
George R. R. Tolkien.
People are going to hurt me together. For that. People are going. I'm now on someone's list for that.
he creates languages and can never finish a book.
So I'm saying the epic medieval fantasy movie, and that really wasn't something that was in the 80s. But we have this, and this is kind of. I wouldn't say at the start, but definitely this is before its kind of time movie, I guess you can say.
I'm going to disagree with that, because I think you're forgetting one of the major things of the 1980s.
Hmm.
Which was the brief, but very influential, at least for like the D&D set, you know, all of us gamer geeks and stuff. This was the height of the sword and sorcery kind of blip in the 80s.
Mm.
So it's building off a little bit of a tradition. A lot of the movies that it was building off of have been mostly forgotten by the public, but held very dear by a certain kind of cult fan base. You got things like Kroll and Dragon Slayer, Legend, even Conan the Barbarian a little bit, Lady Hawk, you know, all these. There was a very small window in the 80s where it was like these very weird action fantasy movies that the public kind of glossed over or made fun of. But to a certain demographic, i.e., you know, those of us that like to sit down and roll dice on a weekend, those were very formative for a certain subset of people. So it's not that Lucas was, I think the idea was ahead of its time. Have we even mentioned the movie we're talking about today?
I was getting there. We are talking about the movie Willow. And yes, this is a Lucasfilm movie, and since Disney bought Lucasfilm, they own it. They didn't just buy Star Wars.
They on Disney Plus.
Yeah, they didn't buy just Star Wars. They bought the whole studio.
Apologies to the fans who are just listening to us ramble on about our own thing. Willow it started out as an idea Lucas had in the early 70s when he was, you know, kind of even before Star Wars was a thing.
Can you imagine if this came out before Star Wars did? I don't think Lucas would have had the kind of clout he would have now.
I'm not sure this would ever have gotten made if Star Wars wasn't.
True.
Because the 70s, the early 70s now, did not have that sword and sorcery, you know, brief moment. Mm. And I think it would have been a much harder sell. You know, it's like, well, it's a fantasy adventure about magic and dwarves and, you know, whatever. I don't think most people would have bought it in the 70s.
Much less around, not just Star Wars, but much less when he did American Graffiti.
Yeah.
Speaking of American Graffiti.
When Lucas is just the American Graffiti guy, Willow doesn't get made. But yes, speaking of American Graffiti.
Our director, Ron Howard.
I also do not think this movie gets made if Ron Howard had not already done Cocoon by this point. Yeah,
he's already jumping off the great success that Cocoon had. Oh, I remember that was such a memorable movie for me. And it's just going to get remembered because it starred the diabetes guy.
Yeah. Oh, Wilford Brimley. Rest in peace. He has just recently left us.
Ron Howard, he's directed. I mean, it isn't even the only Lucasfilm movie he's done. It would be many years, but he did do Solo a few years ago.
Yeah. I will say that prior to Willow, he has already done Splash, which we sort of mentioned a little bit in Little Mermaid, and Cocoon, that are both fantasies of their own to some extent, and also had a lot of effects shots. You had a lot of effects shots in the mermaid transformations and stuff like that in Splash. Cocoon, you got a lot with the kind of alien stuff going on there. So he's made a name for himself enough by the time he does Willow that people are going to not immediately balk at, you know.
They're not going to call him Opie.
It's not Opie or Richie from Happy Days.
Yeah,
trying to do a fantasy film at this point. It's established director Ron Howard, who has already gone down this road before.
Personally speaking, I always found Ron Howard a better director than an actor.
Ron Howard apparently finds Ron Howard a better director than an actor. That he says, looking critically back at his work, he was a serviceable actor, but he thinks he's a really good director. And I think, you know, he's won Oscars for one of those two things. So yeah. I think everybody kind of agrees that was his niche. But he was adorable as a little kid. So, you know. Yeah. However. There is a third part to this kind of recipe that you need to make this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that part did not come in, as far as personnel speaking, that part did not come in until George Lucas did Return of the Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
Because in there, you get adorable little creatures called Ewoks. And the main one of those was played by a very, very young kid named Warwick Davis. I think he was like 12 or something when he got Wicket.
Yeah, when he played Wicket. And even then, he was already kind of prepping himself in filmmaking because he did an entire self-produced documentary of footage he filmed while filming Jedi.
Yeah, Return of the Ewok, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah, I've seen it. They used to show it at conventions back before YouTube was a thing. Conventions would show these obscure little bits of fandom lore kind of in between panels, and I saw it at one point there. Really good. You can already see he's got a lot of talent. He was a big Star Wars fan. He saw the original Star Wars and, of course, being the target age demographic, immediately fell in love with it. And then he heard in England that they were looking for actors who were under 4 foot tall to be in a new Star Wars movie. And he was immediately like, Mom, this is my dream. Make this happen.
It's the perfect role for him. And yeah, even when filming Willow, he filmed a bunch of back behind the scenes stuff that only recently got released to the public on the most recent Blu-ray release of Willow.
He was always doing stuff like that. I don't know if he did anything like that for like the Harry Potter movies or anything, but Warwick Davis is one of the most prolific actors that the general public is not super aware of. He has been in every Star Wars film to date. Even the ones you wouldn't expect, like he's in Solo and stuff, you know, it's he's there. Every film to date since Return of the Jedi. Yeah, it's important. He started in Return of the Jedi, but since then he's recurred in every Star Wars film. He, of course, is the star of Willow.
As Willow
He
himself, yeah.
Was in all seven main Harry Potter films. I don't remember if he's shown up in any of the Fantastic Beasts line of that. He had his own TV series called Life is Short, which is great if you've never seen it. It's a comedy series loosely based on his life. He runs his own talent agency, both for actors with dwarfism and now actors with giantism. He represents people under 4 foot tall or over 7 feet tall to help them get acting roles.
Good dude.
And is incredibly successful at that. And in fact, that is called I think it's called Willow Management or whatever. It's named after this movie because he met his business partner, who is also his father-in-law, while filming this movie. So we have the three personnel now towards the early 80s. Unfortunately, this movie didn't get made until the late 80s because there was one thing that needed to happen before they could film this movie, which was that technology had to catch up with imagination.
And that's always been a problem with filmmaking,
And especially with George Lucas.
even with Disney.
Oh, yeah.
That's why Disney did animation for so long, was because you can do more with animation than you could with live action. And now you can do the exact same thing with live action that you could do with animation.
Yeah. Very similar processes in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So they had to wait for film to catch up with some of the ideas Lucas had for this. And in doing so, broke a lot of new ground. This movie is mainly remembered today by the general public and by film historians for being one of the first to ever use digital morphing, where they would
Yeah.
use computers to combine one image into another image to make it look like one creature was transforming into another.
By today's standards, it's pretty basic, and they can do it so much better with today's technology. But for the time, this was record-setting stuff.
Well, this is like going back and looking at like an early flip book and then looking at, you know, a modern 2D animated film. It's like this is the early flip book. This is the basis for everything that has come after it. They invented this basically for this movie. So it was a monumental technological breakthrough to get that. And then Lucas would go on to use that in other things, in Indiana Jones films and stuff like that. But this was kind of where it started, and this was basically the earliest that computers were capable of processing that sort of information. So let's talk about the cast. We've talked a little bit about Warwick Davis already, so won't go back over that. His co-star in this is a very young and adorable Val Kilmer.
Yes, playing Med Mardigan, the greatest swordsman ever that ever lived. Debatable.
Yeah, debatable. But, you know, Val Kilmer, of course, famously Batman in Batman Forever, played Simon Templar in The Saint. He's also got some animation cred. He's Moses in Prince of Egypt. Of course, he played Jim Morrison in The Doors. That was kind of what boosted him into kind of major stardom. That was his real kind of shove in there. Prior to this, he was, you know, the cute young guy. His biggest role, of course, being Top Gun before this, but he was the second banana to Tom Cruise. So that was his kind of, you know, oh, hey, he's a cute guy, but this was really his first thing, I think, trying to, I guess you could say, lead a film.
Yeah.
It's kind of debatable whether or not Warwick Davis or Val Kilmer is supposed to be the kind of...
Val Kilmer is credited above Warwick Davis in the credits, but Warwick Davis has more screen time.
Yeah, well, Val Kilmer was the guy from Top Gun at this point.
Yeah.
You know, he was just off that like, you know, a year or two before this came out. So, yes, he would have been the household name as the hunky guy next to Tom Cruise, who's also playing volleyball. You know, that Warwick Davis was always in makeup and stuff before this. This is the first time that he ever really got to shine as an actor.
As himself, pretty much.
Yeah.
And then he would go on to play a leprechaun.
Yeah. Hey, don't knock that role. That's a good role. And apparently he loved playing it. We also have, rounding out the cast, we have Joanne Whaley. She was rather new, I think, at the time. She's still... only done a couple of movies before this. This was, I believe, her biggest screen role to date. She would go on to a few other things, but primarily is kind of remembered in film as that chick that married Val Kilmer after they met on the set of Willow. I'm sorry. I don't mean to demean her as an actress, but it really is. She did a lot of TV and stuff in the UK, but she's not super an international name, I would say. We've also got Jean Marsh playing our evil villain here, evil queen, Bev Morda, evil queen. She was mostly known for a English series in the 70s called Upstairs Downstairs, but those who are our age may remember the movie she did right before Willow, which was Return to Oz. So, you know,
Dorothy Gale.
Sorry. Yeah. She was also in Doctor Who as far back as William Hartnell. So, you know, she's OG Doctor Who right there as a guest star. Then we've got Patricia Hayes, who plays the sorceress, the good sorceress, Ra's-el. She is, you would mostly know her as being Urgel in Neverending Story. She was also in some Benny Hill and stuff. Much more known in England than she is in America, though. Excuse me. And then I wanted to make just a real quick thing about a kind of minor character in the film. who was kind of rather important in real life, though. Billy Barty. He plays the main sorcerer, the High Alduin, in the Nelwyn village that initially gives Willow his quest. However, Billy Barty was really well known as a crusader, an advocate for people and especially actors with dwarfism. He was quite well known as an activist. He would go on TV. He would talk about the language we use regarding dwarfism, how people are treated. He started a nonprofit called the Little People of America, which was a major step forward. He kind of famously had beef with another famous actor who also had dwarfism, Hervé Villechaize, who was Tatu on Fantasy Island. Duplain. Yep. That guy. Because they went back and forth over the use of a word. I'm not going to say it. It starts with M, frequently used to refer to little people. Billy Barty found this to be a slur. Hervé Villechaize did not. There was a rather public battle between the two of them over the use of this word. History has kind of sided with Billy Barty, however, on this, which is why I would even refuse to say the word on our show.
Yeah.
So I find that very interesting, and as far as I can tell, did a lot for his community. So you know, good to see him in this one though, and he's really fun in this. I love the bits where he's on screen. I wish he'd have gotten more screen time. Also in this movie is Kevin Pollak. You know who Kevin Pollak is. He's that guy. He's in all the things. Has a kind of a smallish role in
even
this.
Some of the little people actors that you might recognize from other movies, especially I know one of them was in Bad Santa.
Yeah, I think this movie was the biggest hiring of little people since Wizard of Oz.
Yeah,
I think
the fact that even this is something that even Lord of the Rings didn't do, is they actually hired
hired average height actors to play hobbits. Yeah,
yeah, and instead of if George Lucas had directed Lord of the Rings, we could have had Warwick Davis as Frodo.
That would have been awesome. I would have watched Warwick Davis as Frodo all day long.
I would.
On Sundays.
I'm going to be honest. I would.
Yeah. One of the cool little, nerdy Hollywood things about this movie, and I know this is so nerdy film, so I apologize for derailing for a second, but I counted no less than 3 Wilhelm screams.
Oh, the Wilhelm scream.
Film.
George Lucas loves him some Wilhelm screams.
Well, it's not actually George Lucas. It's actually a guy named Ben Burtt, who worked at Lucasfilm, did a lot of sounds for Star Wars and a lot of other movies. He's a sound designer of quite some note in Hollywood. And he, I don't know if he found the thing sitting in some, a sound bank somewhere or not, but he certainly was the one that popularized it. Is there's this weird scream that a guy made for an old Hollywood film, and maybe you can put it in here? Yeah, so that very weird particular scream is like an Easter egg for movie nerds. It is in so many things. It's in the Star Wars movies. It's in the early Tim Burton Batman movies. It's in everything. It's in Toy Story. I've heard it on American Dad. It showed up in S.H.I.E.L.D. in the last season. Yeah, so it's everywhere. Now that you know about it, you can kind of listen out for it during action scenes. It'll usually be played as somebody gets punched and thrown, or an explosion goes off and a guy goes flying through the air. But it is a very particular sound, and once you hear it, you can never unhear it in any movie ever. And it is used at least 3 times in this movie, and I kind of love it. So, I don't know. Just one of those little nerdy things that I love. Anyway, moving on. So let's get into the actual plot here. It's your mostly typical fantasy trope. There's prophecy. Yeah. A child will be born that will bring down a great evil. The details are largely unimportant and never mentioned in the story. All we know is bad guy wants to kill baby. Baby is the key to bringing down bad guy. Supposedly.
Supposedly.
So, yeah, I kind of find this interesting, though, the queen's plan at the beginning, because it's not a bad plan, necessarily, as far as logistics go.
Kidnap all the pregnant women, yeah.
Yeah, she hears that a baby is going to be born that will be her downfall, so she rounds up all the pregnant women she can find and puts them in prison. And the thing is it does work. The child is born in prison. Unfortunately, the midwife agrees to smuggle it out when they realize that this is the child. It has a special birthmark that gives it away.
Yeah.
Because
fantasy.
Because fantasy. So the midwife that helps birth the child smuggles it out. I don't know how the villains are stupid enough to let this happen, but they are. Because the midwife just puts the baby in a basket and walks out of a guarded jail with it as people stand around and watch her. Like, there's like 7 guards, and they just kind of like, oh yeah, midwife leaving with a basket. The basket is crying. I see no problem with that.
Yeah.
They send out, like, dogs and soldiers to search for the baby. The midwife gets cornered and eaten by the dogs, but not before she pulls a Moses and sends the baby on a raft down the river.
Yeah, I was going to say, very Moses-like.
Yeah. Lucas is passingly familiar with the Bible.
Yeah, this is... And it's had to been for a while, because... It's no longer a newborn, you know?
Yeah, this... It's still an infant, but it now has, like, a lot of hair.
And it's considerably larger than a newborn. Yeah. So, at least a few weeks, if not a month?
I would honestly say this is probably about a 6-month-old at this point. Yeah. It's not verbal yet, but it's not, like, newborn.
Yeah.
So yeah, it does seem like the midwife travels a very long way, because we see her passing through like snow and desert and grassland, and you know, it's like all these different biomes there. The baby ends up in a village of Nelwyn, which are their word for fantasy dwarfs, all played by little people actors.
Again, good on them for doing that.
Yeah, apparently that was George Lucas's idea, that he wanted them all played by little people. Just side note, this is the adorable place where Warwick Davis met his wife. Like we said earlier, Val Kilmer and Joanne Whaley met and got married and later divorced. But Warwick Davis met his wife, and they are still together today and have children together. And he founded a company with his father-in-law, who he also met on this thing. But his eventual wife and her brother were extras in the village somewhere. I'm not sure they ever really have proper screen time, but they were on set.
And they even have the kids are also played by young little people.
Oh yeah, every single person in that village. Willow's kids are the ones that find the baby.
Yeah. Dada, we found a baby.
Dada, we found a baby. I'm going to say something about the kids. Child actors are always hit and miss. One of them is hit and one of them is just a horrible miss. I'm sorry. I'm sure she grew into other good qualities, possibly even acting, but at this age it was not among her talents.
She doesn't even have a Wikipedia page, so this might have been it.
Yeah, it might have been. I don't know, but I don't really fault kids necessarily. You know, they're kids, especially at that kind of young age.
Yeah.
But she's very like, Dada, we found a child. You know, it's very affected. The boy seems more natural. He just kind of seems like a boy talking to his father. It's not like an Oscar-worthy performance, but it's realistic and it's fine and it serves the purpose. But the girl is kind of unfortunately wooden. I love that they find the baby and Willow's first thing is put it back on the raft and send it somewhere else.
Babies are nothing but trouble.
Yeah. I felt that deep in my soul. It was like, oh, good, a baby. Is there somebody else here that can deal with it? It's
well, he already crying. Has two kids. He doesn't want to really deal with a third, apparently. Especially when he straight up says that it's a human baby.
Yeah.
It's not a...
I really hate using the word human here, because really the only difference between the Nelwyn and the Daikini are height.
Well, they say, yeah, Daikini.
Really weird. But yeah, they call him the Daikini, which I really don't like that name. Nelwyn seems like a fine name for a fantasy race. Daikini seems like a tropical.
Not all fantasy names by George Lucas are hits.
Yeah. Would you like some death sticks? I brought them from Elan Slee's Bagano. Yeah, so he immediately recognizes that this child does not belong in their village. And is like,
that's the real reason he wants to get rid of the baby.
Yeah, it's immediately kind of a racist thing. He's like, not one of us. Go away.
He even pretty much says, you know, that he doesn't want any big people in their village.
Yeah, they're giants. They're from a land far away. They need to go back there. This does seem to be an incredibly isolated society. At one point, the sorcerer tells them, like, the outside world is no place for Nelwyns. Come back as soon as you drop the child off. You know, it's they seem to be incredibly isolated from the outside world.
It is in a way justified in how everyone else in the movie kind of treats Willow originally.
Yeah, once you get outside their village and everybody's like, you little peck, which is their like slur, I guess, for Nelwyn. Everybody calls him that all the time. I don't think anybody calls him a Nelwyn after he leaves his village. I think he's just always a peck. Which is, like, super duper racist, so I can kind of see why you would stay home in your village and not be subjected to this kind of nonsense.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I love that the tipping point is Willow's wife. She's like, Willow, it is a baby. It doesn't matter whether it's our baby or, you know, the baby of a neighboring civilization. It's still a baby. It's an infant. How dare you?
And I love Willow just saying, you are forbidden from falling in love with that baby. Do not fall in love with this baby.
And then immediately everybody in the family's like, baby! but very quickly, Willow, too, falls under the spell of the baby. I don't get it, but you do you, Willow.
Well, again, he does have two kids, so it's the fatherly instinct in him.
Why, yeah. We see that Willow wants to become a sorcerer.
Yeah, he does some parlor tricks, some generic magician tricks for the village at their festival, but he wants to do more than just parlor tricks.
Yeah, and they very are like stage magician tricks. This is not any sort of like actual fantasy magic. Aldwyn, do they call it? Yeah, the Aldwyn is going to pick a new apprentice. Mm-hmm. And Willow really wants to be the apprentice, so he goes into the main village the next day and unfortunately fails the test along with everybody else who tried. But as he's doing that, the village is attacked by the evil empire, the Nachmar.
The dogs that we saw earlier in the film.
Yeah. So the dogs come in, they kind of rip the place apart. And the entire village, after managing to kill the dog, is like, what do they want? Let's just give it to them so they will leave us alone so we can go back to, you know, doing whatever we want in peace. And Willow reveals that he has the Daikini baby. And the Aldwyn is like, no, this isn't just a normal baby. We can't. You know, we got to do something about it. This is some kind of special magical child, and Willow needs to be the one to take it.
I like how he kind of does his own little parlor trick with the bones. Like, the bones are going to tell the future. Like, the bones aren't telling me anything. What do you want to do?
Yeah, and I like that his decision on whether or not Willow should be the one to take the child is, do you love this child? Because he knows then that Willow will protect it and make sure it gets safely to someone who will take care of it.
Yeah.
But still, there, the quest of the original kind of little party of Nelwyn that sets out, which is a couple of warriors, Willow's best friend, and for some reason the mayor of the town who is a jerk.
Yeah, he hates Willow because he apparently, as the mayor or the ruler of the village, he is the person that sells all of the goods, and Willow has not been buying his goods from him.
Yeah, he's been foraging for seed for his farm and stuff like that. You know, capitalism. Yeah, I don't really know why the Aldwyn sends this guy along, except maybe to humiliate him a little bit.
Well, again, he is the village elder, so he's probably seen this guy since he was a kid, knows that he's a jerk, saying, you know what, time to humiliate this kid.
Also, maybe if I send him on this dangerous quest, somebody will kill him and rid the village of his nonsense.
Yeah.
Because
He even says, like, the bones are telling me these need a leader. You will be the leader, even though he just said the bones aren't telling me anything.
Yeah, the bones have no magic. The quest they're given, though, is kind of weird, given that he wanted to know if Willow loved the child, because they're told to just go to a crossroads that is frequented by Daikini and just give the child to the first person that passes by. Like, here's a baby, take care of it, bye. And they do that, and the only person there is Val Kilmer.
We kind of do skip over a part here, because the elder Billy Barty character kind of takes Willow to the side before they go off and saying, you know, you second-guessed yourself back there. What did you really want to do? Yeah. What did you really want? And Willow says his original answer, said, well, that was the right answer. Why did you lack confidence in yourself? As almost like he sees something in Willow that Willow doesn't see into himself.
Which is odd, because other than the kind of stage magic, we don't see Willow perform any actual magic at this point. So we don't really know what the sorcerer sees in him, or why Willow wants to be a sorcerer. We've not seen him have any potential for actual magic.
Yeah, not...
This is all stuff humans can do in the real world. You know, yeah. Like, oh, look, I put something through my arm, but no, my arm is perfectly fine. Oh, I disappeared a thing, you know, but now it's back. It's that kind of stuff. But yeah, he also gives him 3 acorns that he says will turn anything to stone if you throw it at him.
Which is really weird, is that if it turns something to stone, why doesn't it turn the person, or does it have to be thrown through wind or thrown through the air? It's never really explained either.
Yeah, most of the things in this movie are not explained.
George Lucas was never good on details.
Well, not plot details. I'm sure every person in that Nelwyn village has an extensive backstory that nobody ever heard. Because that's how George Lucas operates. But it's when it's like, hey, George, you know this thing that's essential to the plot? Yeah, it's just a MacGuffin. Don't worry about it. That's not important. Now, let me tell you about the butcher in town. He is having an affair with the wife of the blacksmith. You know, it's like, who cares, George?
So in their adventure, so yeah, they leave the village and they meet Val Kilmer, who's in a cage.
Yeah, he has been sentenced. Why has he been sentenced? We don't know. We'd never find out. There's some talk later about he's a thief. I'm not a thief. Well, you know, maybe, you know, who knows?
Or that he's
in a cage, sentenced to die for, yeah, something. Maybe.
We do get one of the soldiers from his country saying, well, you said you serve no country. That's why you're here. So we may or may not. He may have been abandoning his people. He may be
An AWOL soldier or something. Yeah. I don't know. Again, it's a plot detail that we're just not meant to think about. He's in a cage for reasons.
Yeah.
And he starts with threatening the Nelwyn, and then very quickly he realizes, like, oh yeah, I'm in a cage and can't actually do anything to them. So it's not very frightening. And then he starts, you know, bargaining, let me out and I'll take care of the baby. I know lots of women who can, you know, be a mother to the baby. I'll make sure that she gets a loving home. I'll raise it as my own, yeah.
He vows to raise it as his own child, and it's like, yeah. I won't be a bad person if I had someone to take to care for. You know, I mean, maybe he's being honest about it. Maybe he's just saying what he needs to say to get out of the cage. Could be both.
Yeah. As they're arguing, apparently over the course of a couple of days, an army comes through of good guys off to fight the evil sorceress
queen
army. Yeah, the evil queen's army. Well, she's also a sorceress. She's got magic. She's Maleficent or whatever, except not as interesting. If Maleficent was a dowdy bored nun, there's your evil queen for this movie.
Which makes me wonder about the evil queen is that she has the daughter. She's not at all concerned at all at that early part of the movie that maybe her daughter could be the downfall of her. No, just the baby.
Well, her daughter, I mean, spoiler alert, but her daughter does end up being more the downfall than the baby. The baby does nothing in this film.
Because it's a baby. There's
no reason for this baby to really exist except as plot MacGuffin. You know, it's like... But the interesting thing about the evil queen in this is that how evil is she? Especially at the beginning of the movie, the only evil thing we know is that she's rounded up pregnant women and she intends to do a spell on the baby to take away its power.
So she
it's pretty evil, you know. We can call that evil.
Yeah, I mean, she clearly wants to rule for eternity. So essentially making sure that no one can ever, you know, stop that.
But until the very end of the movie, we don't really get a good and concrete reason for why everybody's fighting this chick.
She's evil because the plot said so.
Yeah, she's evil because the plot has told us she's evil, but they don't actually show us she's evil until very late in the movie.
Well, she does have the baby's mother killed.
Yeah, like I said, you know, she does a couple of minor evil things, but like, what's that Eddie Izzard joke about? You do evil things in your own country, and we just kind of like shrug and go like, oh, sucks for people in those country, but it's when you step outside of your borders that we start considering you a problem. That's kind of how I feel about this queen. Is like, why does everyone else in the world care about whether or not she gets brought down? Because it seems like as long as you don't go into that castle, it's not that big of a deal. But then, like, as the movie progresses, we start to hear, like, throwaway lines like, oh, they sent down an army to some village or whatever. But it's not really set up so much that, like, why this chick is a threat to all the land. You know? So I don't know. Again, this movie is not great on details.
Yeah.
So the
army comes in and, like I said, they meet up with the army and Willow just say, "Hey, take the baby." He's like, "Yeah, we're going to war, kid. We can't take a baby with us into war." And then we get the conversation that maybe Val Kilmer deserted his country, and they're just gonna, even though he is a great warrior, they're gonna leave him in his cage because he abandoned his country.
Yeah. Eric.
Yes. Sir Eric, or maybe a sir, maybe a knight.
General Eric, or who knows? He's a general. He's a warrior of some sort.
He's a warrior. He's essentially the leader of this army.
But yeah, after they leave, Willow just kind of figures, like, okay, nobody else is going to help me. Might as well trust Val Kilmer.
Yeah.
They finally let him go, and he takes the baby and heads his way towards the Daikini villages or whatever, and Willow and the one friend that is still with him, Migosh, I think is the name.
They turn
around and head home back to the Nolan village. And as they're a little bit away, they see the baby flying through the air being stolen by brownies.
Yeah. I stole the baby.
So these little annoying fairy gnome
You're
things.
Coming relief for this movie, folks.
Can we put giant, weighty quotation marks around that? Because the brownies are collectively my least favorite thing in this entire movie.
Again, George Lucas and comedy characters. Yeah, we're about, you know, 20 years away from Jar Jar Binks at this point, but...
You know who they reminded me of more? Watto.
Yeah, that same vocal style, yeah.
But also that kind of mercurial... I want to get drunk, I'm kind of a scoundrel kind of thing. Like, Jar Jar was good-natured. Mm-hmm. You know, he wasn't terribly smart or coordinated, but he was good-natured. He was a good guy. These are like, you don't want to fall asleep near them because they might kick you in the head just for fun, you know? Yeah.
They go all Gulliver's Travels on poor Willow and Migosh.
Yeah, Willow and Migosh get tied up all Gulliver's Travels style. You are correct. But the fairy queen shows up and says, "No, let them go. They are special." And the brownies are like, "Aww." But they do it.
Fairies and brownies. That's I guess the only difference between fairies and brownies in this movie, according to this movie, is that, you know, some are flying and magic and the brownies need are not flying or magic, but they're all tiny people.
Well, they do have some magic. They have, like, the love powder and stuff. But
they say that's the fairy spell, though.
They stole it from the fairies, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one chick is the only fairy we see.
There's the little fairy that kisses Willow.
Yeah, but like this is the only scene we really see fairies in.
Yeah.
It's like they show up for this one plot point and then they are gone forever.
One thing I did notice is all the brownies seem to be male and all the fairies seem to be female. So at least it's a nice little nod in at least as far as this world is concerned.
Yeah, the brownies are also for those of you who read Discworld, they're like the Nacmac Fegal if they weren't interesting or witty. They're just angry and annoying. But the Fairy Queen shows up and she's like, "Oh, Willow, the child's name is Alora Dannon."
Yeah. How does she know that? Well, because the baby told her name. How does the baby know her name is Alora Dannon? I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like the mother was capable of giving her a name before the baby was... Because she literally gives birth to the baby, and they're like, "It has the birthmark! Go get the guard so we can kill her!" And she's like, "Run away!" Like, she doesn't even have time to name this kid.
Unless the baby named herself.
Yeah, it might be one of those, like, "This is your true magic name." Who knows? Anyway, again, not explained. You're just meant to go with it. She is going to be the future queen of some place called Tir Ezlein. What is Tir Ezlein? Why do we care? How do we know that she's the empress? Because her mother didn't really seem like anything other than a peasant in a jail. Don't ask.
It's kind of a King Arthur story, but it's with a birthmark.
Yeah, but King Arthur was of royal blood. He'd just been hidden away. Like, you know, that's the story of King Arthur. Like, he's of royal blood. We don't want him to get assassinated, so we sent him off to live with some farmer. But, I mean, maybe that's kind of an idea here, but it's not particularly...
She was born with the birthmark, therefore she is destined to be the queen.
Yeah, and we're all just going to go with that, because that seems like a way to run a society.
Again, Lucas doing the story and all that. Anyway, so the queen tells her that they have to find the good sorceress Rizel, and so she can defeat the evil queen, and the fairy queen gives Willow her magic wand to give to Rizel, because apparently that is the only thing that can defeat the evil queen.
Yeah. Willow is like, "You know what, Migosh, this is going to be like way more complicated than we thought. Why don't you go home, because you're not really destined for anything, so you get to go home and have a peaceful life, and I have to go off and have nonsense adventures." But two of the brownies, who are now the bane of my existence, and I want to squish these frickin' fairies...
Apparently, the Fairy Queen has endured them to be Willow's guide.
Yeah, I don't know why. They're not useful or interesting or funny in any way. One of them is played by Kevin Pollak at what is, I'm guessing, maybe the low point of his career. I don't know. Kevin Pollak has had a few low points, so maybe not. But it's definitely one of them. But they end up at a tavern, and they end up running into Mad Mardigan again.
Yeah, Val Kilmer.
He's in some shenanigans where he's trying to dress as a woman because he slept with some guy's wife. It's not important or funny or interesting.
There's a lot of...
good jokes.
Yeah,
about men in dresses.
That have not aged. How? Because the wife somehow convinces her husband, "Oh, this is my cousin from out of town who's visiting," and then when the husband finds out that it's a guy in a dress, because he apparently starts to hit on her, Val Kilmer is so good and attractive that, you know, apparently everyone wants to hit on Val Kilmer. Why not?
Well, you know what? That's valid, I guess. If Val Kilmer's your type, Val Kilmer's your type. Go for it.
But when he finds out that it's a man, he goes all macho and tries to start a bar fight. Again, jokes that don't exactly age well.
And really the only reason this scene is here is to provide an escape route when the bad guys led by the queen's daughter, Sorsha, show up to take the baby, and Val Kilmer reveals himself to be a man, knowing that this big brute is going to start throwing fists, and they're able to escape. That's really the only point of this scene.
Also, the scene is just to establish the love potion.
Yeah, they also established that the brownies have a love potion, and one of them falls in love with a cat. It is exactly as funny as that description made it sound. But we get a nice chase sequence here, and this sequence is actually really well done. I really love the wagon chase as Val Kilmer and Willow, and unfortunately the brownies and the baby are on a cart trying to run away from bad guys. Bad guys are chasing them on horses. There is some sword fighting and some jumping from horse to cart and cart to horse, and oh no, we're all gonna die. It's a really good and effective chase scene.
And they're saved. You think, you know, all Val Kilmer and would save the day, but no, the day is saved by the brownies cutting the beer barrels off the truck.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. Fine. Whatever. Still don't like them. You know.
Yeah.
Stomp on them. Be done with it. Put me out of my misery. They make their way to this Ra's-el sorcerer character, but unfortunately she's a possum.
Yes, apparently she's been cursed by the evil queen, so to not have any power to destroy her or something. So while she's a possum, she has no power.
She's been transformed. Yeah, she can't do magic while she's a possum. And for the Americans in the audience, we're talking about the adorable Australian version of a possum. You know, the thing that is cute and you're like, oh, not the kind of nightmare creature that roams American. However, I like possums.
This is not the kind of possum that's going to go into Mexico's pants and make him dance.
Yeah. I actually like American possums. They're everywhere where I live, and they keep the ticks away. They're really good pest control. My dog tried to get into a fight with one recently, and I had to, you know, pull him away and save the possum. That was the last time we saw a possum in our yard, but hopefully they're still hanging around eating ticks, because that is what they're good for. I like possums. Anyway, but this is one of the adorable little Australian ones. The only thing Australia gets that's more adorable than its companion animal in America. For some reason, we got the hell beast and they got the adorable cute thing. But yeah, she's a possum, but they bring her with, and then they're captured by soldiers.
Yeah, they got Meg Mark. It's a blink and you'll miss it moment, but they make it. There is a line there that Willow thinks that Med Mardigan has turned on them by leading the soldiers to him, but then you get this dubbed in line from the soldier says, "Told you we find them without you."
Yeah. There's a lot of kind of major plot points that get hand waved away by really easy to miss lines in this movie.
So you think that Meg Mardigan turned, but yeah, I'm blinking, you miss it. They say that they found him without him. So this character, this rogue scoundrel character, into a bad guy traitor, because we're supposed to like him in this movie.
Yeah. You know, as they're imprisoned, Willow tries to use the wand to turn Ra's-el back into a human, ends up turning her into a raven or crow or whatever.
Yeah.
This is the first time we see part of the kind of morphing effect.
Yeah.
And it's pretty well done. as she turns from a possum into a bird.
And this will kind of quite a bit of it is done with some practical effects.
Yeah. It's a mix in this first one. Eventually it will be entirely digital, but I like the way they introduce the technology via a mix of practical and computer effects that slowly gets more and more computer dependent until it is completely computer heavy. At the end, there are a lot of special effects tricks in this. There's a lot of stop motion, a lot of practical effects, a lot of computer effects, a lot of green screen. Yeah.
Especially with
I'm gonna say that the green screen work is I think the oldest technology that they use. At least the idea of green screen is older than most of the other technologies they use. And it holds up the worst in this movie.
Yeah, this is not, I don't know if this is a 4K restoration or not, but you can really tell the
It looks awful. Yeah. A lot of this movie just looks cheap. Like the set pieces look like, you know, I was making stuff like that for my high school productions. You know, the armor, you know, eventually Val Kilmer gets armor and it's supposed to be all like flash and awesome and stuff. And it's like, I see hobbyists put stuff better than that together for SCA for a weekend. You know, just, I don't know. It's everything about the kind of way this movie is put together on that level is a little bit cheap and a little bit disappointing, except for the morphing technology, which is outstanding and remains so.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened. I guess that's where their entire budget went. That maybe. George Lucas wanted that one, like, one major effect shot. And that's
Ron
where,
Howard.
Like, all of their...
Could have been Ron Howard.
Well, it was George Lucas's idea for the morphing, and that's why they delayed the movie for so long. Maybe. So that was apparently always a major part of the movie.
So since Willow is not a trained sorcerer, he cannot turn Rizel back into a human. Luckily, our friends the Brownies know how to pick locks and get them out of there, but not before accidentally hitting Val Kilmer here with the love potion.
Yeah, and now he's decided that he's in love with Sorsha. They have to go into Sorsha's tent to steal the baby while everybody's asleep. He sees sleeping Sorsha and is immediately like, "You are the love of my life. Let me quit poetry."
Which is weird how this love potion works, because the first person he sees after he gets hit with the love potion is Willow. Doesn't fall in love with him. Doesn't fall in love with the Brownies. Doesn't fall in love with Rizel. Falls in
love with him. Homophobic love potion. 1980s movie. I don't know why they didn't go with the Rizel thing, because she's technically a woman, but also she's in the body of a bird. But one of the Brownies fell in love with a cat.
Maybe it was
when
a female
the potion
cat.
Hit him, so who knows? Yeah, was it a female cat? I don't know.
Maybe it's only, you only fall in love with your attracted gender? Maybe?
I don't know. Anyway, but he sees Sorsha and he decides she is the love of his life, and he's going to, and he almost gets them captured because of it.
Yeah. Luckily for them, the love potion doesn't last very long, since he does eventually snap out of it.
Yeah, by the next morning, he's like, I told her I loved her. I hate her. Like, she kicked me in the face once. I don't like her. But, you know, they've run away again, but unfortunately, the soldiers are not far behind.
And they do... is this the part where they capture her and have her as a hostage?
Yeah, they end up in a village. They find the Eric guy from earlier.
Yeah.
He has a few soldiers with him, not enough to really battle the army that's coming for them. They were apparently wiped out at their previous battle, and this, like, you know, 5, 10, 20 men are kind of all that's left.
Yeah.
They hide, but Sorsha kind of comes down to where they're hiding alone. They're able to take her hostage, and they run away again. They tell the soldiers that they're going to Tir Ezzelin, this place that's apparently important for reasons. Which turns out to be a mistake because Sorsha escapes on the way and she ends up running back to her mom and General Kale. We haven't talked about General Kale. He's just the evil leader of the evil army.
With the Shao Kahn mask here.
With the Shao Kahn mask. But the funny thing about General Kale is General Kale is one of two bits of shade that George Lucas decided to throw at movie reviewers that he did not like, that had previously given his movies a hard time. General Kale is one of them, named after famous reviewer Pauline Kale, who immediately noticed that this is her last name, because her last name is spelled, you know, kind of uniquely. And she apparently put in her review, like, oh, look, an homage to me. How flattering.
I mean, this wouldn't be the first or the last time a director or a creator has made fun of a critic in their film. Like in Godzilla with Mayor Ebert.
Yeah. Speaking of Ebert, the other little bit of shade that he decided to throw is at one point there is a two-headed fire-breathing creature. Apparently, this creature, even though it's never said directly in the movie, is called an Ebor Sisk, which is Siskel and Ebert. Yeah. George Lucas is a petty man, apparently.
Yeah.
Just going to throw that out there.
One thing we kind of skipped over here is that Sorsha kind of says, hey, did you mean what you said back there? That you loved me? That I was your stars and everything? It's like, no, I didn't mean that at all.
And I'm going to say something about feeling for Sorsha. Mm-hmm. It is very obvious that the reason she is so taken aback by what Val Kilmer says to her is that this is the first time anybody has ever said anything nice to her in her entire life. Because everyone else we see talk to her at any point in the movie treats her like absolute garbage.
Even though she is the queen's daughter. The queen.
The queen treats her like garbage and obviously has no love for her. The general treats her like garbage and really only defers to her because it's the queen's daughter, but whatever. Every town they come into hates her because, you know, she leads the queen's army and she's not a very nice person to them. So that's fair. You know, Val Kilmer is the only person in the movie to say a kind word to her up to this point. Now, granted, it was magically induced, but she doesn't know that.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to say that maybe when you're like a horribly abused person that's never had a kind word, you might latch on to the first nice, pretty Val Kilmer-y looking man that says, I'm just going to theorize that that's a thing that might happen to some people.
Yeah, I mean, yes. A person saying nice things to you when you've been abused your whole life is fine. But it doesn't hurt that the guy looks like Val Kilmer.
Well, yeah. I mean, that too. Let's not underestimate how much looking like Val Kilmer gets.
Young Val Kilmer is an attractive looking dude.
But yeah, so Sorsha has escaped. She tells everybody where they're going. Meanwhile, our group of intrepid heroes have arrived at the fabled Tir Ezzelin, where there is supposed to be an army. They've been told by someone that there's an army waiting there. They show up and everybody is encased in crystal. Apparently the evil queen did this at some point. And now there are trolls everywhere.
So yeah, the now frozen kingdom has been taken over by trolls.
Yeah.
And we learned earlier that apparently Willow doesn't like trolls.
Well, honestly, what's to like about them in the way they're portrayed here? They don't seem sentient in any way. They just seem to be like kind of pest animals that are also predators and want to eat you. And I get it, you know, because they don't really show any sort of sentience or anything. They seem like really the most basic animalistic intelligence. So, the thing is that they've got trolls inside the walls and evil army outside the walls, and the only fighters we have are Willow and Val Kilmer. Oh boy.
Yeah, and this is where Val Kilmer finds the armor.
Yeah, the kind of really cheap fantasy armor that is probably made of plastic.
And they make it this big thing that he finds this armor that's supposed to mean something.
Yeah, there's like a light and like a little coral, like, oh, you know, so I don't know. Anyway.
Feels like something was missing here.
This turns into fantasy Home Alone real quick. They start setting up traps for the army and, you know, catapults that will trigger on their own and crossbows that are rigged to go off if you open a door, you know, all that kind of fun stuff.
And and during this, as the trolls are attacking Willow, he uses magic and turns one of the trolls into a two-headed dragon, the Eborcisk, as it's called.
This, however, turns out to be an accidental good thing, because the two-headed dragon just starts attacking anything in its path, the majority of which are now evil henchmen and or trolls. Because the only two good guys in here are Willow, Val Kilmer, and the baby.
Yeah, and Willow tries to use the stone acorns, and great payoff for that. He drops it.
Yeah, he turns the wooden bridge into stone, and then it crumbles away, putting him in more danger.
Yeah, great payoff for that one, George.
But he escapes somehow. This is actually a part of the movie that I was like, maybe it's a blink and you miss it, and I just blunk, but he's hanging from a troll, which is hanging from the bridge, and then the next thing we see is the dragon thing eats the troll, but Willow has somehow escaped and is on one of the bridge supports, like, ooh, you got eaten by a dragon. Sucks to be you, dude.
It would have been fun, or at least been better, if we actually saw Willow throw the acorn at the two-headed dragon, turning it into stone. At least that would have been something.
The troll was the closer, more immediate threat to him and the baby at the time he threw the acorn. So tactically, I can understand it as a move. But
I just wanted a better payoff for the acorns. They kind of built this up the whole movie, and there really isn't a good payoff for them even later in the movie.
Yeah, the acorns are a complete dud. I don't know why they're in the movie. They're pointless, as is so much in this movie, unfortunately. Val Kilmer ends up saving Willow. The dragon, just one of the heads ends up exploding. I don't know why. Again, maybe it's a blink and you'll miss it and I blonk, but I don't know why the dragon head explodes.
And all this time, you know, you're seeing Saoirse looking at Val Kilmer and Meg Mardigan fighting the dragon, fighting the knights, and she's kind of mesmerized by his bravery, by his sword skills, by how he's fighting.
By the fact that he looks like Val Kilmer.
Yeah, I mean, let's be honest about it. You see, you know, 1980s Val Kilmer, it's Val Kilmer, let's be honest.
Yeah, even in that awful hairstyle, it's still 1980s Val Kilmer.
That bad wig?
Yeah, just so horrible. My house was trying to decide if he was that, if the hair was meant to be some sort of mix of Orthodox Jew and some form of Native American, because there's like a sort of native braid down one side and there's like a curl down the other. So it's really bad. It is really bad. Anyway,
And she apparently just decides right then and there she's going to change sides.
Yeah, she's just decided, like, my mother is kind of awful. Maybe I should go with the hot guy. Which is a mistake many a woman has made, I think.
It's not the worst thing a woman has done.
Yeah, but, maybe change sides because your, morals tell you to and not because the hot guy does. Anyway.
Maybe change sides because you don't like the fact that your mother wants to kill a child.
Yeah. I want to go back to the two-headed dragon exploding because only one head explodes and then the other head just kind of lays there. And I kind of wanted it to be like, I'm not dead yet. I've still got another head. I can still breathe fire, but apparently that's just the end of the dragon.
Yeah.
I guess the brain was in the head that exploded.
This is not like a King Ghidorah thing where if one head dies, the other two can still function. It's just one brain split between two heads. Once one dies, they're both dead, apparently.
Who knows? Again, like so much in this movie, none of this is explained.
Since it's supposed to be a riff on Siskel and Ebert, maybe that's Lucas saying if one goes, the other one is useless, which considering
did not end up happening.
Gene Siskel did die about a decade after this movie.
Yeah, and Ebert kept going for a couple of decades more. Anyway. So everything looks lost until Eric arrives with his army. I don't know where he got the army. He said they were wiped out, but he shows up with an army.
Maybe he went back to their village and got more.
Who knows? But
and the baby's been kidnapped again.
Yeah, but in the ensuing chaos of more good guys arriving, the General Kale kidnaps the baby and makes it all the way back to evil castle of the evil queen. He tells her that her daughter has betrayed her, and she's like, "My own daughter that I loved and cared for. Yeah, I don't really care. Whatever. I'll just kill her the next time I see her. Give me the baby." apparently, I don't know why they can't just kill the baby.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's just she makes it that the baby must be alive for some special ritual that she has to do.
And apparently the ritual is going to banish the baby's soul to a realm that it can never return from. So I don't know if, like, does this world have, like, reincarnation? If she kills the baby, will it just be born in a new baby and come back to kill her again? I don't know.
Maybe that's what the birthmark means, that it's the reincarnation of the one true ruler. Would have been nice to have this explained in the movie.
Yeah, it would have been really great to get some explanation here about any of this, George. Thank you.
Like, if they had said something like, this birthmark means the one true ruler has been reborn, then fine. I could understand. It's fantasy. You can get around that.
Yeah, the interesting thing about fantasy, if you're writing fantasy, is that most fans, I'm not saying we won't nitpick and make our own little headcanons or whatever, but we will at least admit that you have tried to give us an explanation if you literally just give us one sentence of nonsense. The birthmark means the reincarnation of the one true divinely appointed ruler. Okay, fine. We can go with that. Magic ruler. We get it.
Like, we've mentioned...
Magic ruler sound like something Miss Frizzle would carry around?
We've mentioned King Arthur. Like, whoever pulls the sword is the one true ruler. We get that. At least that got explained in that story.
Yeah.
Here, we don't even get that. We just get the birthmark means that the queen will die, apparently.
Well, it doesn't even say that the queen will die. It just says that, like, the baby will bring about the end of her or something. I don't know. It's so vague. Prophecies are so vague. Prophecies are horrible. Stop using them. Anyway, they set up for this ritual, and the ritual apparently takes forever. Again, just kill the baby. I'm sorry. It would be faster. But instead, you have to do the complicated ritual, which means that the army has time to arrive. And Bad Morda is like, yeah, whatever. I will turn you all into pigs.
Yeah. Like, she doesn't even use words. She just, you're all pigs. And they all turn into pigs. Even there is a bit of pain in her eyes. She does try to cry as she sees her own daughter standing against her, and she does the spell on her daughter. So there is some sort of caring there.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was a directional or her just saying, you know, what if I did this? Would it look good on film?
Yeah.
But apparently, yeah.
As about 100 people are turning into pigs outside a tent, Willow is inside a tent with Razel.
Doing some sort of protection spell.
He's trying to turn her back human. And this is where we get the famous computer morphing scene.
Yeah.
Willow, using the Fairy Queen's wand and some magic that Razel has taught him, ends up turning Razel from a bird into a goat. Oh, yeah, he turned her into a goat at one point when they were in the last battle. So he had turned her from a bird into a goat, and she ran around the battle as a goat. Now he's changing her from, like, a goat to an ostrich to a tiger to a whatever. To a turtle, and eventually into an old woman. Apparently, she has been an animal for so long that she has turned from a young and beautiful woman into an older woman.
Yeah, she even looks at her hand saying, has it been that long? And earlier in the movie that she does say to Mad Martin, to Val Kilmer, I'm a young and beautiful woman. To kind of give him incentive to help her. Like, if you help me, I will turn into a young and beautiful woman. That is as far as she's saying. She doesn't say she'll do anything else.
Yeah.
But as a guy, he's going to go, yeah, let's get the beautiful woman back.
Well, when she tells Willow how to do the spell, she tells him to envision her, and she says, remember, I am a young and beautiful woman. And apparently that's not a joke. Apparently when she was turned, she was a young and beautiful woman, and that is her residual image of herself that's left in her mind. That is her last memory of her human form. But I guess she was kind of constantly aging while she was in animal form, which seems weird because I think compared to how long it would take her to turn from a young and beautiful woman into the older kind of frailer woman that we see in the film, that possum would have died.
Well, maybe she still has
like 80 times
magic. Because apparently she still would age as a human even though she would be as the animal. I don't know. It's never explained.
Like so much in this movie, there is no explanation for this. Anyway.
Even Willow apologizes afterward. Like, he feels like it's his fault she's an old woman now.
Yeah, but she doesn't blame him. It doesn't seem like the magic went wrong. It just seems that she lost track of time.
Well, she was alone on an island for who knows how long.
Yeah, and also, we don't know how long this evil queen has been a ruler. Like, and when did she become, like, when did she become the big menace to the entire world? Because it seemed like she was just allowed to hang out for 40 years doing whatever she wanted in her castle, and then suddenly she's, I don't know. Anyway, so, as the never-ending ritual to kill this baby goes on inside the castle...
Yeah, she has a blade in her hand. Just, I mean, I'm not to say anything. You could have ended the thing right then and there, but no, she has to... You think she's going to stab the kid, but no, she's going to cut a lock of the baby's hair off and do this
add
long...
Add it to a potion and invoke lightning and who cares? Anyway... I'm like, you're in a tower, just throw the baby out the window.
I mean, she's evil, so why not, right?
Yeah, it's like, wouldn't that be the way you would write an evil character? Like, this baby is going to kill me. Oh yeah, it's a baby. I can
yeet!
Just wash it. Yeah, just yeet it out the window. It's fine.
We do not advocate for that. It's just she's an evil character. You might as well write her to be evil.
Yeah, it's like you don't have to approve of it, but at least have some logic behind it. Anyway.
So anyway, Risa has turned the entire army back into humans.
And put a protection spell on them so that they won't be in pigified ever again, apparently. And they're sitting around making battle plans because that, you know, that ritual is going to take forever and a day. So we got time. Sit back, have a beer, make some battle plans. Doesn't matter. Willow gets the idea of digging holes.
Yeah, so apparently they have gophers in this universe.
Yeah. His village has gophers, and it gives him the idea to dig pits that will then be camouflaged that the army can hide in. So that when...
They're digging trenches.
Yeah, when the sun comes up, the people on the walls, the evil soldiers... They think that, oh, they were pigs, because they never saw them change back, apparently, because middle of the night. They were pigs, all the pigs ran away, and now the only two people left are the old woman sorceress and, you know, the little Nelwyn dude.
Yeah.
And Willow says, we're really powerful magicians. We are more powerful than the evil queen. We will kill you all. Open the door and let us have the baby and we'll let you live. And instead they're like, open the door and go kill those two easily killable people.
Yeah.
At which point the soldiers come up out of their, you know, camouflaged pits and completely lay waste to the evil army.
Smart. Again, trenches work in military use.
Yeah, Willow is a tactical genius. If Willow was evil, Willow would have thrown the baby out the window. But it gives time for Willow and Sorsha and Roselle to make their way to the tower to confront the evil queen.
Yeah.
Who is still carrying on this freaking ritual. Yep. There is a battle of magic. Sorsha basically gets taken out real quick and is just kind of sitting in a corner going, Mother, no. Razal and the Evil Queen have a battle. That's a little bit better. You know, they're powerful sorcerers. They throw around a couple of spells. Furniture gets broken.
Yeah, the beauty of having a magic battle... Even see movies like Harry Potter, you don't necessarily need a lot of stunt work. Just a lot of special effects.
Yeah, just the, you know, have the actors wave their hands around a little, you know, have something in the background blow up. It's fine.
Probably a lot easier than doing lightsaber battles in Star Wars.
Yeah, you don't really have to train people to really do... Well, unless it's like Doctor Strange and you have to do all that complex hand choreography. Apparently Benedict Cumberbatch like had to work with a choreographer to get all that nonsense down, but no, it looks awesome on camera.
Point a stick, wave it around, and there's your magic.
Yeah, Willow is the very much like, you're a little kid with a stick, wave it around and pretend things are happening. Which is my favorite sort of acting. But Razel ends up getting, like, you know, something falls on her and she gets knocked out or whatever.
But she still has the upper hand, even though she's been knocked down.
Yeah. But Willow gets the wand, they fight for a little bit, and then the wand is knocked away, so Willow goes, hey, I've got an acorn, I will turn you to stone. And he throws it at the evil queen, who catches it. And her hand starts to turn to stone, and you're like, go, Willow, you did the thing! That paid off! And then her hand just turns back flesh, and she laughs.
Again, the no payoff for the acorn that they built up for us in this entire movie. They had two chances to pay off the acorn. One was with the two-headed dragon, and the other was with the evil queen.
Yeah. Willow is able to get the baby off of the altar. And
although I do love that at this point in the movie, Willow finally finds his confidence. Like, I am a great sorcerer. I'm the greatest sorcerer in the world. And he throws the acorn. Like, nice delivery, nice confidence in your line. It's too bad it turned out to be a wet fart.
Yeah, it's like, sorry that the plot was against you there, buddy, but you did good. But he is able to get the child off the altar, which pauses the ritual. Mm-hmm. That has been going on now for over 12 hours because it has gone from dusk to dawn at this point in the movie. And is able to kind of like cower behind some whatever. But the evil queen says, give me the baby. I want the baby and I will let you, you know, live. Just hand me the baby and walk away. And Willow says, no, I will send the baby to a land where no evil can ever touch it. And teleports the baby away. And the blanket falls down and the queen goes, no. Which, okay, I actually had to look up somebody else's like review of this to try to figure out what happens here because it makes so little sense.
She knocks over some sort of potion, probably the potion made from the baby's hair.
Yeah, it's like blood and baby hair potion. And we see her making it at the start of the ritual.
So yeah,
and then because she knocks it over, lightning strikes her, and then she turns into red smoke and screams and is gone.
So the person to defeat the evil queen was the evil queen.
Yeah.
She destroyed herself. Like, you could say that the baby had a part of it because her hair and possibly part of her blood was used in the potion, but that's a stretch.
Or if you want to stretch it even further, you could say that the evil queen wouldn't have done the spell that ended her life if the baby hadn't existed and she hadn't thought the baby was going to do her some harm, but like at that point it's so circular, who cares?
It would have been better if again, two things besides the acorn. The other would have been she raises the wand because now the evil queen has the magic wand and is about to kill Willow, and then she gets stabbed by her own daughter.
Yeah, if the daughter had done anything, if the magic wand had done anything, but this is like a real like Deus Ex altar thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like lightning comes out and is like, no, I don't like her. You know? I'm sick of watching this movie.
So essentially the ritual potion, blood, hair concoction was supposed to go onto the baby and banish the baby's soul from this realm forever. And it turns out since the potion fell on her, or she knocked it onto herself, she banished herself. That's just weird.
I mean, that's one theory, but like so much in this movie, none of this is ever explained. But who cares? The evil queen is gone, and for some reason, this means everyone is happy again.
And we find out, where's the baby? Oh, I just used the magic trick I used at the beginning of the movie to make the baby disappear.
Yeah, it's honestly just like a stage illusion. You know, a sleight of hand thing.
It says a lot when stage magic is able to fool an actual sorceress.
Yeah, that is a weird thing about this movie, is that in a world where actual magic exists, so many people are so, like, taken in by the simplest illusion magic from the real world.
I mean, that is just David so Copperfield weird to me. Would be a god in this universe.
Yeah. yeah, I don't know. It's just I want to see a movie about Teller, the silent god of magic.
Yes, let's do that.
He is small and never speaks, but boy is he amazing. The chatty one, we don't worship him though. He's very annoying.
It'd be anyway. Teller and Penn. That'd be the awesome movie.
Teller actually made a YouTube series about being one of the only people to survive the zombie apocalypse. And he filmed it in the deserts outside of Vegas with a bunch of his magician friends. And it's called And Teller, because Penn is dead at the beginning of the movie. So it's just called And Teller, and you can find the whole thing on YouTube, and it is awesome. It is one of the coolest things I have ever seen. It's just like, if you ever wanted to see, like, The Walking Dead, but it stars Teller. I realize that I am the only person at the intersection of that Venn diagram, but it was exactly my thing. But, so... Yeah, so Willow is the hero. The Razel gives him a book of magic so that he can become a real sorcerer when he gets back home. Sorsha and Val Kilmer are now
parents,
a couple, and they're the baby's parents. And the baby is apparently going to be the Empress someday or something for reasons. Here as Lean, we still don't know where this is or why this is important or who cares, but apparently all the people are uncrystallified, although that is never explicitly stated in the movie. It's just they're back at the old castle and there's a bunch of people around.
Yeah.
That's how you know that happened. So again, it's blink and you'll miss it because this whole scene is about 30 seconds. Willow goes back home. He comes into the village. Everybody's like, Willow is alive. He grabs an apple, throws it up in the air. It turns into a bird, and they're like, and he's magic. The bird craps on the horrible mayor guy from the beginning of the movie. The movie ends with a poop joke, which is about the best metaphor for this movie that I can think of.
You do get the reunion between Willow and his wife, though.
Well, yeah, him and his wife hug and kiss. Like, yay.
We kind of did skip over something. We kind of skipped over something. Is that Willow gets a lock of his wife's hair as a good luck charm, and that never pays off.
Well, he looks at it at one point longingly, and Razel is like, oh, your wife. That's about the payoff.
They could have pulled a Harry Potter and saying love was the strongest magic of all.
Yeah, I mean, his wife is kind of, you know, madam not appearing in 90% of this movie. It's just a reason for him to go back home instead of staying with Val Kilmer and being, like, the court sorcerer for the future baby empress.
I would say Orko, but a He-Man would have come out the next year.
Yeah. I almost made a Skeletor joke, but honestly, she's more like if Rita Repulsa had a bad day. Like, it's really like if Rita Repulsa was like really uninteresting and understated. That's kind of what this evil queen is.
Yeah, I can see it. So yeah, Willow's home, poop joke, end of movie.
Yeah. That's Willow.
Yeah, that's Willow. And
that certainly was a movie we watched.
Yeah, I remember this movie being better when I was a kid.
I do too. I asked my father about it, and apparently he does not remember this movie being better when I was a kid. yeah.
I guess he had to be the right age for this movie.
And apparently the right age is young enough to laugh at a jerk getting pooped on by a bird.
Yeah.
If that final joke makes you go, you're apparently the correct age for this movie.
And, I mean, I can understand why this movie has, like, a cult following. I can understand why people would love this movie. But, and the special effects are okay.
Well, the computer special effects, the stuff they invented specifically for the movie is okay. Everything else is, like, really, really poorly done. Even for this time.
So, yeah, I think this would have to go into this is nostalgia versus this is still a good movie.
This movie is not horrible. But this movie is very beige. Is there magic? It depends on what you consider magic for this. There's nostalgia magic. Yeah. I had good, like, oh, I remember this. There was a little bit of that. The plot was the biggest fail. I will say the greatest thing in this movie, though, Warwick Davis is a really good actor who never really gets to act.
Yeah.
Warwick Davis is one of those character actors that by default of the height he was born, okay, by default of medical condition, he has been relegated to put on this costume, put on this makeup, and dance, you know, kind of thing. But this movie, he's actually acting. There's character growth. Whenever Willow is on screen, you are very engaged in him as a character. The rest of the plot doesn't make sense. I'm going to be honest. Val Kilmer is a plank of good-looking wood in this. With a bad wig. He is so boring. Val Kilmer is a good actor. I've liked him in many a movie. This was not one of them. Everybody else in the movie seemed to be phoning it in, but Warwick Davis, who was still really young at this point, I think he was like 19 or whatever, he was so happy to be given a part where you could see his face and know his name, and he got character development and more than just a cameo on screen, actual dialogue to speak. He was loving life in this movie, and it comes through in every scene. He is so good in this, and
which
it is
really
such
does
a
make
crime.
Me wish that they had, you know, Warwick Davis as Frodo. I mean, I'm
yeah,
three
this
movies,
is such
three...
a crime that he did not have a better career as just an actor.
Yeah.
You know,
or if Game of Thrones was made. All
yeah,
those
if
years
Game
ago.
Of Thrones had been made back then, you know, he would have probably been in the running. I think the thing is that I think because he started so early and because he started when he did, he took the roles that were offered to him. I think that by the time somebody like Peter Dinklage came along, he had the... he had the benefit of people like Billy Barty and people like Warwick Davis who had been pioneering things in the industry.
One walked so the other could run.
Yeah, and I think that Peter Dinklage did a good thing where he was kind of like, no, I'm gonna play humans. I might play humans of less than average height because, I mean, let's face it, you know.
Yeah.
But he always plays, like, humans. You know, he just plays people.
Yeah, I mean, he would not have been able to play Trask in X-Men if it wasn't for, really, Warwick Davis' Willow.
Yeah, I wish, and honestly, as Warwick Davis has gotten older, there have been more of those roles. Like I said, there's that Life is Short. Which is all about just him being a working actor and trying to get roles on his own merit. And it's a really good kind of incisive look at Hollywood from a slightly different perspective. It also has, if you're like a big Star Wars and sci-fi fan, it has cameos from like so many people. But I really did feel kind of the loss of, like, I'm not saying he hasn't had a good career, because any actor should want to work as much as Warwick Davis does, but I think he is kind of a thankless actor in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really glad Willow exists so that he got at least one film to truly shine. To
yeah.
truly show you that he's an actor who just happens to be short instead of a gimmick.
Yeah.
Which I love.
He deserved like, better. I mean, he's still around, he's still alive. He's still like
yeah.
like you said, he's working with other actors, little people and large people, who just trying to get acting credits on their own merit, as opposed to, like I said, as opposed to being a gimmick. And if he didn't have that career, he wouldn't do that as being an agent right now.
Yeah. And you know what? As with any other group that does not really get as many opportunities in the entertainment industry, you know, it doesn't matter what you look like if you're a voice actor. And honestly, even if you're talking about live action roles, little people exist. Just yeah. like black people exist, just like gay people exist, just like it doesn't have to be a gimmick, you know? I mean, while something like Tyrion Lannister, yes, him being a dwarf, you know, his having dwarfism in the book is a major part of his character, and it was a bit in the series, you know. It informs his character, but it's not the entirety of his character. You know? There are so many other adjectives you would use with that character, and it also feels like, you know, well, he is a nobleman, and he has dwarfism, but he's also one of the smartest people you will ever meet. He's extremely well-read, he's extremely good with the ladies, he's, you know, there's all these other things you can talk about. And with Willow, I guess because in the movie they set it up as like, no, he's not an abnormal human, he's normal for his people. I think maybe audiences at the time were able to just kind of be like, you know, I will take this character on his own merit rather than being like, oh, isn't he good for a little person? You know, like, yeah. Oh, I don't know. It really annoys me because I'm thinking, like, how much talent is there out there that has never gotten a chance because they don't look as pretty as Val Kilmer, or they're the wrong shade of melanin, or they're too tall, or they're too short, or they're too fat, or too whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, like, there's so much talent out there, and you're getting rid of 99% of it to keep this, like, narrow worldview of what you think is normal and correct, and I'm so sick of it. I want to see, like, variety, just out of, like, interest, if nothing else.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, think that's... Yeah, it's what I say about the Chrises in Marvel. It's like, oh, look, another guy that looks like a Chris.
Like, well, we've been on this thing for about 2 hours now. Sorry. I think it's time to wrap it up here. So
general idea
is nostalgia, but it doesn't really have enough magic to kind of be on its own.
Put it on in the background. Don't think too much about the plot. Talk about how awesome Warwick Davis is. There you
go. Let's move on to what we're doing next week. And there's a certain holiday in September that you and I are very good advocates for. But why only celebrate for one day? That holiday would be International Talk Like a Pirate Day. And why only celebrate pirates one day a year? Why not talk about it for the entire month? So we'll be doing Pirate Month for the entire month of September. And we're going to start with, some would say, an underrated movie. In this, we are talking about Treasure Planet. And I'm going to be honest, I've never seen the entire movie.
I have. I'm looking forward to watching it again to see if it holds up the way I hope it will. I remember liking the movie very much. We will see if I do on a rewatch.
So, yes, everyone, come back for Pirate Month as we're talking about Treasure Planet. And until then, we will talk to you all then. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Rewatching the Magic. We invite you to keep the magic going by joining the conversation online. Find us on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic, on Twitter at Rewatch the Magic, And of course, find all new episodes at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com. Until next time, remember, the magic is for everyone. It only stops if you let it.
Starts in 1951 when we listen to the sound of the distant drums. Met his maker in the jaws of an alligator. There were six screams taken, but one proved to be greater than the rest. So let's fast forward a bit to the Feather River and meet a young private with the lungs that could deliver the kind of cry that only girls spoke alive. He unleashed a mighty scream as his thigh was incised. Ben Burtt, perhaps you may have heard of him. He noticed a certain sound emanating from a bunch of films, decided it was perfect for a film that he made. So he lifted it and placed it in the Scarlet Blade. From that point, his sonic signature form, one that Ben used fairly often in his sound design chores. To this very day, if you happen by his anime and listen very closely, you can hear him say, that calls for a Wilhelm scream! That calls for a Wilhelm scream! That calls for a Wilhelm scream! Scream a little louder, gotta make a big scene! That calls for a Wilhelm scream! That calls for a Wilhelm scream! That calls for a Wilhelm scream! Scream it through their heavens so they know what you mean! Over the years, the scream has made many appearances. It sounded out in Warner Brothers films for 20 years, and then the aforementioned Ben created sounds for Star Wars. Take four began to show up in movies galore. A stormtrooper stumbled into a shaft because Luke shot him. Another was chucked into the freezing chamber by Chewbacca. Crocodiles enjoyed the thug as Indy knocked from the bridge. Jabba lost a bunch of henchmen in the Sarlacc pit. Mr. Big smacks some people in the street. Buzz Lightyear met a lamp and tumbled head over feet. The King Crusader punched a clown and tossed him clear out the frame. Grenades exploded in the Last Crusade. There's numerous other scenes featuring violence and tension. Young Indiana Jones has too many Wilhelms to mention. I bet the sound designers meet near to here to figure out which films will get the scream this year. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. Scream a little louder, gotta make a big scene. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. Scream it like you're lacking proper oral hygiene. Now don't believe that the scream can only be used on the screen. You can use it wherever you see a need. Got a problem that should probably have the proper punctuation. Try a Wilhelm, make it emphasize any bad situation. That big jerk from accounting just stole your promotion. Your dinghy's leaking in the middle of the ocean. That eBay idiot left you negative feedback. And the money you gave that bum was converted to crack. The lid can't be extracted from your jello pudding cup. It's hard to surf or port efficiently stuck on dial-up. All you need is a knife, but there's 10,000 spoons. They're making a Michael Bay film of your favorite cartoon. The Spanish Inquisition tries to burn you at the stake. Cavity creeps gave you a toothache. The enemy force is just outside your archer's range. That cell phone soccer mom didn't signal her lane change. Gotta pee, but the urinal's unflushed. You find yourself on outer space lacking the right stuff. Frequent visits to the store that you never yet chase figure. You didn't remember the team of the hero's finale, now did ya? Invaders from space leveled all the major cities. There's no more freaking milk for your bowl of Cocoa Krispies. Whenever it seems you've been given a raw deal, it's time to scream it like you mean it. Let them know how you feel. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. Scream it little louder, gotta make a big scene. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. Scream it like the doctor's finally found a vaccine. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. Scream a little louder, gotta make a big scene. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. That calls for a Wilhelm scream. Scream it like you found out she was only 16.